Orson Welles is best remembered for his innovative work in three media. In theater, most notably Caesar, his groundbreaking 1937 Broadway adaptation of Julius Caesar. In radio, with the 1938 broadcast The War of the Worlds, one of the most famous in the history of the medium. And with movie classics like Citizen Kane, which is consistently ranked as one of the all-time greatest films. Also, Magnificent Ambersons, Touch of Evil, and many others. And he left behind a lot of unfinished films and also lawsuits. Oscar-winning filmmaker Chuck Workman has made a new documentary called Magician, The Astonishing Life and Work of Orson Welles, that mixes interviews with archival footage. It is playing at the Lincoln Plaza Cinema, and I'm very pleased that it brings Chuck Workman to our show today. Hello.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Why do you refer to Welles in your title as a magician? Do you mean his magical creativity or his actual magic act, which he toured Europe with during World War II? He even sawed Marlene Dietrich in half?
He certainly did, and would do it again if he was around today. The magician, of course, is a metaphor for what he did with himself, the way he kind of recreated himself and performed magic both in his life, in a way, in terms of the way he lived and the way he tried to live, and in these movies, which change each one. So we think that Citizen Kane is just the top, and maybe it is, but these movies changed and got better and better, in my opinion anyway, and hopefully that's shown in the film.
And some of them now are considered masterpieces, like Chimes at Midnight, although at the time they had a hard time. Bosley Crowther gave it a terrible pan in the New York Times.
Well, Magician got a bad pan in the New York Times too, but that was the only pan. So Bosley Crowther was wrong, and maybe the lady today was wrong.
You include extensive commentary from Welles. He obviously was interviewed a lot over the years. Did you want to give him the opportunity to narrate his own life?
I didn't know that there was such a wealth of material, and that one of the things that's so interesting about him, I was calling him a charming genius, and there's plenty of geniuses that make movies and plenty of charming people, but not the same. And he was never bitter in these interviews. He might have been bitter about things that happened to him, but he was always ready for that interview. And it was as if you interviewed someone who was just terrific all the time. But we had 47 years of this from various places. So it was great to dip into that all the time for the movie.
When I think about some of the other directors that you include in the film, Spielberg, Scorsese, Bogdanovich, Richard Linklater, Henry Jaglom, they do not share a style, and yet they also all claim to have been influenced by Welles.
The reason, I think, is because Welles was working in the 40s and the 50s. This is before the incredible renaissance of European cinema in the late 50s with Bergman and Fellini and the French filmmakers and English filmmakers. And suddenly, things became available to do. Things were allowed, in a way. And I think that Welles's influence is seen in looking at those films and saying, those are not studio films. Those are independent films. And so, in a way, Linklater and Jonathan Rosenbaum, the critic, also says, he was the first independent filmmaker. He was before Cassavetes. I mean, he was before, but there was no independent filmmaking in the United States at that time, except experimental filmmaking.
Well, Isabella Rossellini told me about her father having dinners with wealthy people to get enough money together to make a film. Then he'd make the film, and then he'd go back to having these dinners with wealthy people. It was something that Europeans did, and to some degree, Orson Welles strikes us as very much a European filmmaker, even though he said he liked working in Hollywood, although Hollywood didn't reciprocate the feeling.
Exactly right. He loved Hollywood. He loved the craftsman of Hollywood. And his style actually changed when he went to Europe, because he was shooting shorter scenes and he was shooting with different kinds of actors. He was using dubbing language much more than he did before. He loved the old Hollywood, the old-timers, the moguls, although they didn't reciprocate in a way.
And Europeans did appreciate him. Couldn't he have just had a career in Europe, as some other American filmmakers did?
Well, I don't think that many did. I think that he was working all the time as an actor in Europe and could.
But you had Joe Losey. Actually, had a whole bunch. You had.
It wasn't
Never
an easy.
Never on Sunday was.
Yeah, it wasn't easy. I mean, Never on Sunday was a result of the blacklist and people that went. He didn't run away from the blacklist. But he was trying to raise money all the time in the same way that Rossellini did. I mean, he was going to those same lunches. And he would ask, at one point, he tells a story, may or may not be true, that he invited Winston Churchill to say, come by my lunch table. They were in Italy. And just tell me and say hello. And so he can help them raise money.
Was he hurt at all by the blacklist? Because he worked in his early American New York theater days with many of the people who were blacklisted.
There's a file that we had access to of from the FBI, from Hoover, et cetera, that of over 300 pages where they talk about, oh, he met some woman and he watch out for him and we were watching him. But he was never on trial like the others were. But he was very much a progressive. And people don't really know that he was so advanced politically in a way that he dabbled in that even as a kid in his 20s.
He had a really complicated childhood. He grew up in both Chicago with his mother and in China with his father. And then he gets his first job in Dublin.
Right. He went to his mother was kind of a socialite in Chicago and would ask him to perform all the time. So he had to show off in a way all the time when he was 8 years old. His father had made some money selling a small automotive company or something in the automotive business and kind of lived the life of a playboy. So he was in China. He also owned a hotel in near Chicago. So Wells was kind of part of that life. He went to a very progressive private school where he really was allowed to do as much acting as possible. We have people from that school, one of his classmates, who said he wasn't very friendly or he wasn't.
Yeah, he almost comes across as Asperger's at that time.
Possibly. He was only interested in the theater and interested in himself. And I think that's a key to him is that he felt that he had to really constantly show off who he was.
Now, why do you think he became so innovative so quickly? For example, with the Federal Theater and the Mercury Theater, he mounted an all-black production called Voodoo Macbeth. At a time when that sort of thing wasn't done?
He, like other great artists of the 20th century, I think that modernism has something to do with this, like Picasso, like Joyce, like Stravinsky, he had to kind of push the envelope a lot. And so he would do that in everything he did. When he got to Hollywood, they didn't necessarily want him to do that so much, but he still, his entire career, wanted to do more and more and more. And so you can see that as you look at all these things.
Although he keeps on going back and forth. He's Lamont Cranston, the shadow, for a time in radio. But then, of course, there was that 1938 Halloween radio broadcast of War of the Worlds. And the exaggerated news bulletin format, even the sound going dead, you would think that people would have gotten it. And yet it was really effective in fooling people into thinking that the Martians had invaded New Jersey.
I'm not sure in 1938 that they would have gotten it. I think that they believed it was news. And, of course, they could have switched right back to, whatever other show they were watching. But they thought it was news. And it was basically a Halloween trick that he was doing. And then he had to kind of answer for that, and because he did scare a lot of the country. Well, that was true, apparently.
And is that what made him a household name?
He was a household name even before that, in theater. So that when he got to Hollywood in Citizen Kane, and one of the scholars that we worked with said he was as well known in the late 30s as Hitler.
He kept on turning down RKO, and then they offered him this incredibly lucrative contract. He was only 25 years old when he made Citizen Kane. A film ranked by most critics and film historians as one of the greatest of all times. But it didn't make money. Has it ever made a turn to profit?
Citizen Kane, you'll have to ask Mr. Warner Brothers. But the one film supposedly that he made a profit was called The Stranger with and it wasn't much of a film. It's one of his minor films.
Edward G. Robinson.
Edward G. Robinson, Loretta Young. He just took it as an assignment. And, of course, they cut that one up, too.
But he had to have a lot of chutzpah because he really did introduce all sorts of innovative ideas in making of Citizen Kane. It's more than just the way he tells the story. It's also the way he shows the story. It's incredibly cinematic for somebody who'd never made a movie before.
Well, he was, as I said, a great artist. I mean, he thought of it as part of his art form. So he was very innovative before that. So when he went to Hollywood, he assumed that he could be innovative. And he was. And he, not knowing anything, he basically used all the wonderful craftsmen that were available. And he would just ask for something. And he even said himself, and it's in Magician, that the fact that he didn't know anything helped him.
But he must have known that he was going to anger William Randolph Hearst.
I think he didn't care. I think that
well, that hurt him.
Well, that we do often things that hurt us. But he went into it as an innocent, in a way, as a very sophisticated artist, but as an innocent guy in Hollywood. And he said, well, why can't we do this? He could have played it safe with Citizen Kane. He could have made a very safe movie or any of his other movies and had a wonderful career in Hollywood. And, you know, been William Wyler or whatever. But instead, he wanted to really say his own statement. And if William Randolph Hearst didn't like it, too bad. But it did hurt the movie, obviously.
But the Magnificent Ambersons could have been William Wyler. Why did he lose control of it?
He was shooting on Pearl Harbor Day. That's December. He was also asked by Nelson Rockefeller and others to go to Brazil for Carnival, that's March of the next year, 3 months later, to do a film for the war effort. So he had to finish filming and start editing. He wasn't there for the editing. The war had started. This is all the apology for Wells, and bear with me. And so they tested the film the way he left it. And it was, you know, kind of a serious film and slow.
It was an art film.
Of course. It was a beautiful, beautiful film. But it didn't test well. Meanwhile, he's in Rio and there are reports that he's having parties and having fun, but he is making a film there. So they recut the film. They took his end and supposedly it ended up in the Pacific Ocean, the negative. And he lost like the last third of the film in a way. So the film is not you don't feel that this great, potentially great film is a complete film. I don't anyway.
Did the film he made in Latin America, was that ever released?
It was released many, many years later because they had fired him from RKO and they took away whatever the money or whatever support they were doing, so he had to come back from there.
You include the famous shooting scene in A Hall of Mirrors from The Lady of Shanghai, just one of the most brilliant pieces of cinema. Why wasn't that a hit?
Who knows? You know, it could be that the audience wasn't ready for that. They wanted to see a Rita Hayworth movie with a love story and all that. And it became, and of course, an underground hit and incredibly famous. There's other scenes in that film that are also spectacular.
And then Touch of Evil, which was again botched up to some degree by the studio. Another brilliant film, but maybe too dark for audiences?
Another problem was with Touch of Evil. That's where he plays this big, fat detective and almost a caricature of himself, of this character. He took this chance in the same way that he took the chances in all his films, that he's going to direct himself, but he's going to play, for various good reasons, a very strong and interesting character. Well, that character, you know, it was basically a B-movie with Charlton Heston when it was set up. And it became this incredible film with beautiful, beautiful scenes. And it now has a great reputation. In fact, some people feel it's better than Citizen Kane in many ways.
And what do you think about his acting? What did he think about his acting? He played Mr. Rochester in Jane Eyre, Harry Lime in The Third Man. They were hits. Obviously, he was in Moby Dick. Did he like acting?
Of course, he liked acting very much. He thought he was an actor, actually. But then he became, he says, married to movies, to the cinema, and he wanted to be a filmmaker. What's interesting about his acting is his rival at the time was Olivier. And there was no Brando in those days. There was no Actor's Studio. There might have been the beginnings of it, but there wasn't really the great artistry of acting. I think that if he were around today, with the example of Brando and others, he would have looked at his acting much more seriously. But after a while, it just became a way to make a quick living, and he
could be a little hammy at times.
Oh, of course, he knew it. He even said, you know, in our film, he says it.
Now, he also, there's an unfinished film from the 70s, The Other Side of the Wind, which I understand is being completed now?
It's being finished. It was kind of almost on Showtime a few years ago, and there was some objections with the estate or something. But I think they've worked that out. And Peter Bogdanovich and the producer Frank Marshall and a third partner are working on it as we speak, apparently, to try and get it ready. It was almost finished. There are a lot of notes around, and both Peter and Marshall were on the set in those days. But it would be great if it came out. They're hoping that it comes out for Cannes in May or something like that. His 100th birthday is May 6th.
You often prepare the In Memoriam segment of the Oscars telecast, which honors people in the film industry who died the previous year. Is that what got you thinking about doing something on a larger scale for Wells?
No, I think I do that like Wells did Taras Bulba. I mean, I do that. I love doing it. I try and do my best. The memorial actually is not exactly what I used to do for them. I thought it would be
the wine commercials.
I guess it is the wine commercials for me. But I really feel, I mean, I don't do it with my left hand. I always did it. I did 20 shows. I always loved doing it.
But you have to pick the perfect scene, don't you?
And I did trailers before that where you have to pick the right scenes. So I got this reputation of doing these montages and I still do. I mean, I'm still working on that kind of stuff.
Do you, in fact, your Precious Images was selected for inclusion in the National Film Registry. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Do you think young people know who Orson Welles is?
I find that almost all of them do. Every once in a while they don't, but but I think they do. And when I teach, I see that they do.
Chuck Workman's Magician, The Astonishing Life and Work of Orson Welles is now at the Lincoln Plaza Cinema in the Upper West Side. And I thank you so much for being on our show today.
Yeah, thanks, Leonard. Interesting.